You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning. I know we'll have some people still coming in, like I say, due to the traffic delays. And it's a pleasure to welcome this many of you who have already shown up, given the weather and the traffic. My name is George Perkovich. I'm a vice president for studies here at the Carnegie Endowment. And it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this morning, Sig Harrison, who is now director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy, but is known to those of us at Carnegie, or who even before we came to Carnegie, for 22-year tenure here at the Carnegie Endowment, where he wrote books and other treatments of Pakistan, South Asia, Balochistan in particular, among the five books that he's written on South Asia. And Sig and I go way back, including his work on North Korea. But the genesis for this meeting here this morning is we ran into each other on the sidewalk, as sometimes happens. And he told me about this report that he just finished on Pakistan, and he kind of described it to me. And I said, well, you know, send it to me, send a draft to me, and let me take a look. And I did, and it's now in this form, Pakistan, the State of the Union. But I was so taken by the report and interested in its insights and suggestions that I asked Sig if we could host an event for him here. And of course, he said yes, and here we all are. And I think you'll agree if you read the report, which I think you should take the time to do. It actually looks longer than it is. It's a quick read. Time, and Sig's going to give us kind of a tour of the report, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, without further ado, Sig.
Thank you very much, George. Well, the reason it isn't as long as it looks is that more than half of it is working papers, and so you can deal with the good stuff rather easily. I want to thank the Carnegie Endowment for some wonderful years here. I want to thank the Center for International Policy. Bill Goodfellow, the director, is here this morning, and the Plowshares Fund for supporting Pakistan, the State of the Union. I'm going to start with a citation from the scripture. Scripture for me on the subject of Pakistan is an important book called The Shadow of the Great Game, The Untold Story of India's Partition by Narendra Singh Sarila, a retired Indian diplomat who was the ADC to Mountbatten. He got unprecedented access to the British archives. In his book, he presents detailed, definitive evidence showing that as early as March 1945, Winston Churchill and the British General Staff decided that partition was necessary for strategic reasons. They deliberately set out to create Pakistan because Jinnah had promised to provide military facilities and Nehru had refused to do so. This is the key to understanding why Pakistan is so dysfunctional. It's an artificial political entity. The British put together five ethnic groups that had never before coexisted in the same body politic historically. The Bengalis were the biggest. They outnumbered all of the other four combined, the Punjabis, the Pashtuns, the Baluch, and the Sindhis. Five became four, of course, when Bangladesh seceded. As it happened, I was in Dhaka during the Bangladesh crisis of 1971, when the Pakistan Army moved in to crush the independence movement. I had a memorable conversation with Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, in which he said it would be best if the Bengalis did secede, because Pakistan would be more manageable without them. What he meant was that he would have a better chance of running Pakistan in cooperation with the Punjabis if he could get rid of the Bengalis, whom he referred to, by the way, in some very disparaging terms as emotional and so forth. Well, that's what happened. Mr. Bhutto did move into power in the West, what became Pakistan, except that the army, as you know, eventually executed him. The army bequeathed by the British to Pakistan was overwhelmingly dominated by Punjabi officers and soldiers. So, with the Bengalis gone, the Baluch, the Pashtuns, the Sindhis have faced a cruel historical irony. For centuries, they had resisted the incursions of the Mughals into their territories. But now they found themselves ruled by Punjabis who invoked the grandeur of the Mughals to justify their power. Together, the three ethnic minorities in Pakistan today constitute only 33% of the population, but they consider 72% of Pakistan's territory to be their ancestral homelands. That is a prescription for built-in conflict. Let's look at the Baluch first, because they have an active insurrection going. They never wanted to be in Pakistan. They had to be forcibly incorporated in 1958 by a Pakistan occupation army. The army still has cantonments scattered all over Baluchistan to cope with an insurgency that is suppressed periodically, then soon revives. The insurgency is fueled primarily, in my view, I argue in my book, by Baluch resentment of the Punjabi economic exploitation of Baluchistan, especially the extraction of most of the natural gas used by the rest of Pakistan on what the Baluch consider unfair terms. Baluchistan has enormous natural resources, including oil, that can't be developed until the insurgency ends. And, of course, from the point of view of the Baluch, the question is who's going to develop it, who's going to control the development, how much of a share will they get? There are 22 foreign investment projects in Baluchistan now on hold. So this is a big, debilitating economic problem for Pakistan, in addition to a political and a military issue. The army and its intelligence agencies do their best to divide the Baluch by buying off and assassinating their leaders. In the last several years, they have killed two strong leaders of the Baluch insurgent forces, first Akbar Bukti and more recently Balach Murray, making them martyrs. At the moment, the Baluch armed struggle does not have effective united leadership. The ISI is at work trying to keep them divided. But the 6 million Baluch are politically more aroused than ever before. There are still some moderate Baluch political figures who favor staying in Pakistan if the minorities get the provincial autonomy envisaged in the 1973 Constitution. But support for independence is growing. The ISI continues to round up Baluch and Sindhis without giving them access to lawyers and courts, despite the advent of the so-called civilian government in Islamabad. More than 900 Baluch and Sindhi activists have disappeared without a trace. I urge you to read the Amnesty International report, denying the undeniable and forced disappearances in Pakistan, which cites chapter and verse on this massive violation of human rights, more than the much publicized disappearances in Chile under General Pinochet. Now, by themselves, the Baluch are in a weak position militarily, but they're beginning to forge alliances with Sindhi factions that could become significant. What the Baluch and Sindhi leaders are talking about is a sovereign Baluch-Sindhi federation stretching from the Indian border to Iran. The most obvious impediment to this dream, of course, is the fact that Karachi is right in the middle of the area concerned, with a multi-ethnic population. But the Baluch and the Sindhis point out that Karachi depends on gas and water pipelines crossing through areas of the surrounding countryside under their control. So they believe this is not an obstacle. Well, in my report, I conclude that the future of Sindh and Balochistan will depend both on what happens in Pakistan, whether the central government implements the autonomy provisions of the 1973 Constitution, but also on how relations between India and Pakistan evolve. Until now, there has been a consensus in India that a stable Pakistan is in the Indian interest. But Pakistan's failure to act against Lashkar-e-Taiba since the Mumbai attacks has led to some rethinking. As Indian anger grows, so does the view in India that India should support Baluch and Sindhi separatism, either as an alternative to full-scale military retaliation against Pakistan or as a key part of a two-front military strategy. Now, as an alternative to a full-scale war, stirring up the Baluch and the Sindhis would avoid the risks of a direct military encounter with Pakistan that could escalate to the nuclear level and lead to an exodus of foreign investment. As part of a two-front strategy, Indian support for Baluch and Sindhi insurgents would keep substantial Pakistani forces tied down on the long Sindh frontier, while others face Indian forces in Kashmir or the Punjab or both. For the past 5 years, Pakistan has accused India of aiding Baluch insurgent groups through its consulates in Afghanistan, but hasn't provided supporting evidence, although most of the Pakistani figures that come to Washington will tell you, and many have said in various speeches, that Hamid Karzai's brother, Wali Karzai, is the conduit for aid to the Baluch. But no evidence has been provided. I've asked repeatedly for briefings to show me chapter and verse, anything they have. So in my view, that these charges have lacked credibility because the Baluch have fought with ineffectual small arms that fit what the Baluch themselves say. They say that their weaponry has been purchased on the black market with funding from Baluch compatriots in Dubai and other Persian Gulf states. Now, should India, in fact, decide to give the Baluch large-scale, sophisticated weaponry, logistical help, and funds, they could rapidly expand their present force of 4,500 fighters, drawing on the large numbers of Baluch unemployed. Now, I want to stress that although I feel it's important to recognize the connection between India-Pakistan relations and the ethnic tensions in Pakistan, at this stage, India remains officially and I think unofficially committed to the assessment that a stable Pakistan is in India's interest. And I don't want to be misunderstood. But those of you who have continuing contact with many people in India know that Mumbai has had a terrible psychological impact, a lot of which is not reflected in what is a very restrained posture on the surface in India. So I'm simply saying just be aware of what's going on beneath the surface in India, the rethinking that's beginning to occur, and recognize the interdependence of these two problems. At present, the prospects for an independent Balochistan or a Baluch-Sindh federation appear remote. But the game changer would be a war between India and Pakistan, in which the Indian Air Force might directly support Baluch insurgent forces. In past battles with the Baluch, the Pakistan Air Force has bombed Baluch insurgents and civilians alike ruthlessly, and the Baluch would need Indian air cover to take and hold territory. In addition to their enormous firepower, it's important to keep in mind that the Pakistan Armed Forces now control a wide-ranging business empire with assets of $38 billion, according to Ayesha Siddiqui, that gives them the economic staying power needed to sustain a protracted struggle. Well, whether or not tensions with India do lead to the breakup of Pakistan, Baluch and Sindhi separatist groups are likely to increase their paramilitary capabilities in the years ahead. Thus, unless the central government pursues a peaceful accommodation with the minority provinces, Pakistan's already serious economic problems will be intensified by debilitating ethnic tensions. These tensions will hinder economic development and make the implementation of foreign investment agreements impossible in large sections of the country. In my report, I discuss in detail what is necessary for a peaceful accommodation, especially implementation of the 1973 Constitution, leading to a meaningful devolution of power to the provinces, which so far has not taken place at all, despite the advent of a civilian government that says it's for that. Now I'm going to turn to the Pashtuns. It's necessary to bear in mind that the 41 million Pashtuns on both sides of the border, Pakistan-Afghanistan border, have a long history of unity. This is often forgotten by people who've sort of come on this, onto this whole, these issues recently. Prior to the British Raj, the Pashtuns had been politically unified since the creation of Afghanistan in 1747 under the banner of an Afghan empire that stretched eastward into the Punjabi heartland of what is now Pakistan, up to the Indus. It was traumatic for the Pashtuns when the British seized 40,000 square miles of ancestral Pashtun territory between the Indus and the Khyber Pass, embracing half the Pashtun population, and then imposed the Durand Line over the protests, of course, of Afghanistan, formalizing their conquest. And the Durand Line isn't accepted by any significant elements of the Pashtuns. The British subsequently handed over this territory to the new government of Pakistan in 1947 after a controversial 1947 referendum in the northwest frontier province. And I'm going to take a minute to talk about this because I think that it's important to understand how the Pashtuns in Pakistan came to be in Pakistan. The referendum was administered under the control of British colonial authorities. They openly favored the accession of the province to Pakistan. Any of you who've read Sir Olaf Kerr or any of the other writings of the British commissars of that period in the Pashtun areas will understand how important this was viewed by the British. Out of 572,000 eligible voters, only 292,000 voted. This was because the referendum was boycotted by many Pashtuns. The Pashtun parties that had overwhelmingly won the 1946 provincial elections wanted the referendum to include the option of an independent Pashtunistan, in addition to a choice between India and Pakistan. The leaders of these parties were imprisoned prior to the referendum. Their newspapers were banned after these parties adopted the Banu Declaration, calling for Pashtunistan formally on June 22, 1947. And out of those Pashtuns who did vote in tribal gatherings, which the British convened to pull this off, all but 2,894 voted for Pakistan. So the issue was decided by 50.5% of the eligible electorate, according to the British authorities, amid charges of blatant rigging that still resonate today. And if you look at one of the working papers in my report by Humayun Marifkail, you'll see what a Pashtun who is now an American and lives here and works for the U.S. government considers important about this history. After the creation of Pakistan, Zahir Shah's monarchy, Muhammad Daud's republic, and the short-lived communist regime in Kabul have all challenged Pakistan's right to rule over its Pashtun areas. At times, Afghanistan has espoused the goal, as you know, of an autonomous Pashtun state to be created within Pakistan. At times, an independent Pashtunistan to be carved out of Pakistan, and at times, a greater Afghanistan that directly annexes the lost territories. Now, the resistance movement against the Soviet occupation and now the U.S. offensive against al-Qaeda and the Taliban have produced deep divisions in Pashtun society that make the future of the Pashtunistan movement uncertain. The traditional supremacy of the Malik over the Mullah in tribal society was weakened when the United States, together with Islamist groups in Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf, channeled weapons aid and funding for the anti-Soviet struggle to favored Islamist clients in Afghanistan. This was at the behest of the Directorate of Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, in Pakistan. The ISI's objective was to build up surrogates opposed to the Pashtunistan concept. And a lot of us wrote about this whole issue during the Afghan war and warned that the United States was creating a big future problem by allowing Pakistan to build up these Islamist elements. When these surrogates proved unable to consolidate their power after Soviet forces left, the ISI turned to the Taliban, which had a Pashtun base, but was dominated by clerical leaders, Pashtuns, with a pan-Islamist ideology. Significantly, however, the Taliban government that ruled from 1996 to 2001 did not accept the Durand Line, despite Pakistani pressure to do so. Well, notwithstanding the divisions in Pashtun society produced by the convulsions of the past three decades and the resulting growth in the power of the mullah at the expense of the malik, the Pashtuns continue to have a powerful sense of collective identity rooted in an ancient tribal structure that still defines their lives. Many people have written this off as a result of the factors I mentioned, but I think that would be a great mistake. The preeminent British expert on the Pashtuns is Richard Tapper, Professor Emeritus at the London School of Oriental and African Studies. We should bear in mind what Tapper says, quote, "In spite of the endemic conflict among different Pashtun groups, the notion of the ethnic and cultural unity of all Pashtuns has long been familiar to them as a symbolic complex of great potential for political unity," unquote. So often in our thinking about foreign policy issues, we look what's happening today or maybe yesterday, but we don't look at underlying attitudes and psychological motivations. Military action in the Pashtun border areas by the Pakistan Armed Forces and, of course, by the drones, the predators, and the reapers has resulted in widespread civilian casualties, as you all know. But I think the political impact of this is not adequately recognized. The newly politicized and radicalized Pashtuns of the so-called federally administered tribal areas, known as Fatah, now see themselves as political brethren of the Pashtuns in the Northwest Frontier Province and the northern corner of Balochistan. There's a Pashtun consciousness. We read a lot about Waziristan and Fatah and what we have to do to get al-Qaeda there, but we're not placing this in the real political context. The Pashtuns want economic development, but they want development under Pashtun control, not under the control of the Punjabi-dominated central government. This is very important in terms of much of the nitty-gritty debate about what to do in Waziristan now and how we can dump more hundreds of millions of dollars in there. More important, by arousing a Pashtun sense of victimization at the hands of outside forces, the drones, the conduct of the war on terror in Fatah in general has strengthened the very jihadi forces that the U.S. seeks to defeat. The Taliban has its leadership base in the Gilzai Pashtun tribes. So U.S. policy has enabled the Taliban to pose as the champion of both Islam and of Pashtun nationalism. In the conventional wisdom, one or the other, either Islamist or Pashtun identity, will eventually triumph in the Pashtun areas. But there's another, to me, equally plausible possibility, that the result could be what Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S., Hussein Haqqani, once called over the lunch table with me, an Islamic Pashtunistan, embracing some or all of the Pashtuns on both sides of the border. At a Washington seminar on March 1st, 2007, at the Pakistan Embassy, Haqqani's predecessor as ambassador, Major General Mahmoud Ali Durrani, who is a Pashtun, commented, quote, "I hope the Taliban and Pashtun nationalism don't merge. If that happens, we've had it, and we're on the verge of that," unquote. Now, moving toward a conclusion, what does all of this mean in terms of U.S. interests and policies? The reduction of ethnic tensions is directly related to how we deal with al-Qaeda, and I will discuss that first. Then I'll consider how a breakup of Pakistan would affect the struggle against jihadi forces in Pakistan and broader U.S. interests in South Asia. To destroy the al-Qaeda infrastructure in Waziristan, we have to get the cooperation of the Pashtun tribes and the Pashtun Taliban leaders who are giving al-Qaeda sanctuary. But in fact, as I've said, what we're now doing reinforces Pashtun support for al-Qaeda. Sending in Punjabi soldiers and inflicting Pashtun civilian casualties with drone attacks has increasingly driven the Pashtuns into the arms of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And as I said earlier, this has increasingly politicized and radicalized the Fata Pashtuns. Of course, the drone attacks have had some success. But as Bruce Riedel has observed, quote, "it's like going after a beehive, bee by bee." The benefits, in my view, are outweighed by the political costs. And yet I see no sign whatsoever that this use of the drones is being reconsidered. In fact, I think it's being accelerated and greatly increased. My report argues that the United States should stop the drone attacks, stop encouraging Pakistan to send in Punjabi soldiers to fight Pashtuns, and focus on creating a favorable political environment for low-profile, covert operations designed to separate the Taliban factions from al-Qaeda. Most of the Taliban factions focus operationally on local objectives in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They don't pose a direct threat to the United States. The secular Pashtun leaders of the Awami National Party, who are now governing in Peshawar, running the NWFP government, were right in trying to get a peace deal in Swat. And it's not clear that it was foredoomed to failure. Some of them think that Islamabad overreached by insisting on appellate jurisdiction and control of judicial appointments. They think that the deal might not have collapsed if Islamabad had been more flexible on these issues. Now, it's been very difficult to get at some of the nuances and important details of what's been happening in Swat for the past couple of months. But I do think that the whole notion of peace deals has been discredited is very, very premature. I think the United States should encourage peace initiatives with Taliban factions in Pakistan, just as we are now planning to do at the local level in Afghanistan, as was outlined in Obama's policy statement about Afghanistan. The idea of peace deals was first discredited during the Musharraf period, but it's not generally recognized that those deals were negotiated by the ISI. They were not negotiated by the Awami National Party or anybody in the Pashtun areas, and thus they didn't have local standing. The report also recommends that the United States should demonstrate to the Fatah Pashtuns that it understands their political aspirations. The Fatah Pashtuns don't want to be ruled by the Punjabi-dominated central government as is now being proposed. There are proposals to bring Fatah under the direct control of the central government. What they want is integration into the NWFP, a Pashtun area now administered by a Pashtun ministry, which won all 10 seats, by the way, in the parliamentary elections. As an international crisis group report on March 13th explicitly recognized this fact, endorsed this idea of integrating the Pashtuns, the Fatah, into the Northwest Frontier Province. This would place them under the same legal system, the same Political Parties Act, applicable to other Pakistanis. the United States should encourage the integration of FATA into the NWFP. There are ways of making it known without directly appearing to violate the sovereignty of Pakistan and the central government, that this is what the United States would like to see. The United States should encourage the creation of a unified Pashtun province, which is now being sought by many elements in the Pashtun areas. Uniting NWFP, FATA, and the Pashtun areas of Balochistan and the Punjab, all of which are contiguous to the other Pashtun areas, in one entity to be called Pakhtunkhwa. The Pashtuns want a stronger position in relation to the Punjabis. And U.S. support for that objective would completely alter the psychological climate in which the campaign against al-Qaeda is operating. Now, when you talk with a lot of people in Washington and the U.S. government in think tanks, you talk about psychological climate, they go to sleep on you. But I think that the problem with our foreign policy in general, and certainly in this situation, is inadequate attention to underlying currents of nationalism and psychology. As I have said earlier, the emergence of an independent Pashtunistan would not necessarily threaten U.S. interests if it is under secular leadership. Similarly, an independent Baluch-Sindhi federation would not necessarily conflict with U.S. interests because the Baluch and the Sindhi areas are strongholds of secular values and moderate Islam. Most of the Sindhis are Sufis, and many of the Baluch are Zikris. They reject the Wahhabi and the Deobandi brand of Islam pushed by the Sepah Sahaba and other virulently anti-Shia Sunni groups in the Punjab. The Islamist threat is centered in the Punjab, where Lashkar-e-Taiba and other hardcore jihadi groups are increasingly strong. Nevertheless, my report argues that the secession of Balochistan and Sindh is not desirable and not likely if the autonomy provisions of the 1973 Constitution are honored and if tensions between India and Pakistan subside. I have used the word debilitating several times because it best describes the impact of ethnic tensions in Pakistan. Ethnic tensions will steadily debilitate Pakistan, even if it hangs precariously together. Reducing ethnic tensions has been made more difficult by the United States, which has created a Frankenstein by pouring in military aid for the past half century. We now confront bloated armed forces that have become a privileged elite, have a vested interest in holding on to power. They smother civilian government in Islamabad. They oppose the constitutional reforms necessary to stabilize the federation. The United States should do what it can to strengthen the civilian leadership and encourage a devolution of power, but it may be too late. President Zardari does what the army wants in order to hold on to his position, and Prime Minister Gilani works with the ISI to outflank Zardari. It's not a pretty picture what we see in Islamabad today. The result is that the civilian government lets the army and the ISI do what they want in the minority provinces, and Zardari, despite his promises and a lot of rhetoric in the early months of this new government, is afraid to implement the 1973 Constitution. The U.S. could help to reduce ethnic tensions by cutting back very substantially on military aid, including the cash subsidies known as coalition support funds, and by encouraging civilian control of the ISI. There's an excellent blueprint for U.S. policy in a book just published by the Carnegie Endowment, Reforming the Intelligence Agencies in Pakistan's Transitional Democracy, by Frederick Greer, who was a member of the advisory committee of my study and is now directing the Asia division of the Defense Ministry in Paris. In conclusion, the U.S. faces a crisis in relations with Pakistan and India right now that bears directly on the issues we have been discussing. The Pakistan government has taken no significant action against Lashkar-e-Taiba since the Mumbai attacks, and it has just released two of its leaders who had been under house arrest. none of its militias have been disarmed. Despite this, the administration is asking Congress to approve another $10.5 billion in aid, and congressional leaders are considering all kinds of conditions, some of them desirable, except the most important one, cracking down on Lashkar-e-Taiba. India is increasingly upset about Pakistan's lack of action, and I believe there is a deceptive calm in India-Pakistan relations. Another Lashkar-e-Taiba attack would undoubtedly lead to Indian retaliation of some form, including covert or overt support for Baluch and Sindhi insurgent forces. So, the bottom line is that confronting the jihadis in the Punjab, keeping Pakistan together, and preventing another India-Pakistan war are inseparable. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank Sig. That was one of those great talks. There was something in it for everyone not to like, and so I.
There are texts available to any of you who have to leave early.
Right. Yeah, I think they're out. They're right outside on the table. So let's open it up for discussion. And please raise your hand. Someone will bring you a microphone. And then please introduce yourself and your affiliation. And if you don't, I'll remind you. And let's have a discussion. Let's start right here.
Hi, thank you so much for your presentation, Malou Innes at the Cato Institute. You mentioned for your recommendations for the United States to cut back on the coalition support funds and to encourage civilian control of the ISI. How would that exactly happen given the fact that the ISI as a bureaucracy would have a vested interest in the perpetuation of the status quo? It wouldn't want to cede more power to civilians. How would that be able to come to fruition?
I would welcome anybody in the audience telling me what the answer to that question is. No, seriously, I think that Frederick Grar in his book, which is the reason I mentioned it, he's really looked at this very carefully. So rather than attempt a clumsy answer to this, I would say read Frederick Grar's book. It's a realistic, gradual, sensible approach to things that could be done step by step to empower the civilians. There's one very important arena in the National Assembly, however, that does bear mention, and that is the question of whether the defense budget, including the ISI budget, is transparent, is made available to National Assembly, to the defense committees of the Assembly, of the two houses. And one of the advisors to the Zardari government made a statement a month or so ago that the new defense budget would be presented to the Assembly. It wasn't clear whether it would go before committees, and it's not at all clear that that's been done. I haven't been able to find out whether anything's happened on that. I'm very skeptical, but I think that's the first step. I'm not sure whether that's Frederick's first step or not, but it seems to me that transparency is a good issue. Nobody's against it. It's like motherhood, and so I think that the trying to get as much of the ISI's budget exposed to committees comparable to the oversight committees of the U.S. Congress would be a good first step. But I certainly agree with you, and that's why I said that it may be too late to do much about all this. We've got tremendously powerful entrenched armed forces, all kinds of elite positions in the society they don't want to give up. And at the moment, I don't see any reason to believe that the U.S. would like to see the U.S. would like to see the ISI purged of bad guys, but it's cooperated with the ISI going back to the early days of the Cold War. So,
in the back there.
Thank you. Evelyn Farkas from the American Security Project and formerly with the WMD Commission.
Hi.
I have a question that pertains to the nuclear weapons and nuclear security and how your scenario would interact or impact upon nuclear security and the security of the facilities to include, obviously, test sites in Baluchistan and in the region in general.
Well, many Baluch activists and leaders are even now trying to focus attention on the issue of tests, past tests in Baluchistan and future tests. I think that I wrote a piece in the New York Times ran last year. They put the charming title on it, Drawn and Quartered, in which I talked about all these issues. And I made a reference in that to what I thought would be a Punjab, if there was a breakup of Pakistan, what would be a Punjabi rump state. That didn't go over very well with many of my friends in the Punjab. But I do think that the point that I made there and that I think is really important is that the nuclear weapons are, from what I've been able to find out, secure. And the Army seems to be good at this security from everything that I think the U.S. government knows. U.S. hasn't been able to participate in this, but they've been able to give all kinds of equipment and training and so forth. And so everybody has anxiety that jihadis may creep into the system there and do something, get hold of nuclear material, but the nuclear security of the Pakistan Army, it seems to me, would continue if you ended up with Sindh and Baluchistan creating a separate state. If you ended up with a Pashtunistan, you'd have a rump Punjab. It would be a very powerful state with rich agricultural lands. A lot of the industry of Pakistan is there. The army would be in control of it, and the army would continue to guard the nuclear weapons. So it seems to me that the idea that somehow the unlikely scenarios that I've outlined of a breakup would not necessarily affect the nuclear issue. The nuclear issue is dangerous because in any bureaucratic system, there are a lot of people whose sympathies you don't know, and it could be somebody in the system in Pakistan who's going to get in to where they, one of the many storage locations, and get hold of that stuff. And it would be a reasonable, serious, and it certainly should be a serious concern for all of us. But I don't think it would be materially affected by the devolution of power, more power to the provinces, or the breakaway.
Can I just jump in on this a little bit, which is to say that we tend to focus on the loose nukes problem, you know, which your question raised, but we I wouldn't say we understate, but sometimes we do that to the neglect of the actual state conflict problem. And what I was hearing in some of the scenarios Sig was painting was actually the worry not of loose nukes but of a conflict where you could get escalation, an actual nuclear war, which is actually one of the reasons why I think it's less likely, for example, that India would in a very major way support kind of secession or a conflict in Baluchistan, or certainly not their air force, and precisely because of the concern about how that would escalate. But if any of those scenarios did occur, and if Pakistan attributed correctly or incorrectly, India with a role in that, then you can actually get not loose nukes, but a conflict where you really have a risk of escalations, which I think is another dimension of what Sig was talking about.
I think that's absolutely very, very. You've made the central point, I think. I do think that I want to emphasize that India has had a very sober and responsible posture in the face of the provocation of Mumbai. And for many, many years, there has been a consensus that a stable Pakistan is in the interests of India. And so I want to be clear that what I'm doing is what I think we should do in a discussion of this kind, which is look at possible future possibilities and recognize that there would be consequences to a continued failure on the part of the Pakistan authorities to deal with the militias in the Punjab. Muzaffarabad, Maridki, camps where there are paramilitary capabilities weapons stored. Nothing whatsoever has been done to try to deal with this. Now, you sometimes get this, and I think that this is exasperating to people in India, the release of the two leaders. And because India is trying to adopt the posture of dusting off Pakistan as a second-rate power that we don't deign to worry about, we don't understand what's going on beneath the surface, I think, in Indian thinking and about all this. But I am concerned that the jihadi forces in the Punjab are growing. You change the name of Lashkar-e-Taiba to Jawad-ud-Dawah, and then you change the name of Jawad-ud-Dawah to whatever this new foundation is, and along comes the SWAT tragedy, and you have 2,000 volunteers of Lashkar-e-Taiba recruiting people under the cover of humanitarian relief in SWAT. So this is a growing problem. It is not being dealt with by the authorities in Pakistan. The U.S. is focused on the Taliban, and we have absurd statements by Hillary Clinton about the Taliban taking over Pakistan. The danger to the Pakistani state comes from the Islamist movements centered in the Punjab. And the fact that they have militias and encampments with weapons, and that they are in touch with certain friends, closet Islamists, if you will, in the ISI, in the armed forces, if there's a danger, and I'm not one of those who thinks this is an imminent danger, but if there is an Islamist danger to Pakistan, to Pakistani state, it is from the Islamists in the Punjab. And the U.S. is doing nothing significant to condition its aid on action on this. Many people in Pakistan will say, oh, you can't do that anymore. They're too strong. Now, if that's the situation, if they are too strong to deal with, which I don't believe, I mean, you know, but it's 6 of the 9 divisions of the Pakistan Army are in the Punjab. Now, it's true that some police in local areas have, Ambassador Tariq Fatemi, who was here a few weeks ago, he said to me that the police are in the pocket of these Islamists in the Punjab, in the areas where they are strong, Jung, Bawalpur, and so forth. So it's true that this wouldn't be easy, but I really think that we're not focusing sufficiently on the real Islamist problem in Pakistan, which is disarming and confiscating the weapons of Lashkar-e-Taiba. And this is connected to what happens with in relations with India, because we just don't know what Lashkar-e-Taiba might do. Its whole program is dedicated to destabilizing India. That's why it was created.
Surjit Man Singh, American University. Singh, much of what you said points to a continuous, more than half century, investment by the United States in the very forces that are now destroying Pakistan. How do you explain the inability of the United States government to change its perspective, to recognize the dangers, and to change its policies? This is what I find most difficult to understand.
Well, I think the word myopia sums up the problem that bureaucrats have. You've got an immediate set of problems. You focus on those problems. I can remember arguing with people in the system in the late 80s about what we were doing in the allowing Pakistan to allocate aid in the way it was allocating it. And I remember Alexander Haig, and when I wrote my book about Afghanistan, I had some sessions with Alexander Haig. He said, well, we understood that was going on, but we didn't feel we could do anything about it. So there's a kind of tail wagging the dog factor that operates. The U.S. always feels that somehow Pakistan has the leverage. It's afraid of a showdown. Right now you say, okay, get tough on military aid. People in the system say to you, well, you don't understand. We have to get our stuff into Afghanistan, and that has to come in through Karachi, and if we get tough with Pakistan, they'll say, okay, no more. You know. Well, it seems to me that there's something wrong with this, this logic. The whole Pakistan economy is dependent on the U.S. Postponement of debt repayments, the U.S. encouragement of the IMF, keeping Pakistan afloat, And I think that we're not dealing with marginal issues, dealing with important issues, basic issues. So I think myopia, it's just a tendency to focus right now on how do we find Al-Qaeda and what can we do about it, and the drones seem to be something we can do. And I guess maybe the can-do spirit, this feeling you've got to do something. Don't just let things take their own course, but do something.
So there were two things which I thought I'd mention to you because I thought you were different from what's been talked about here. Shuja Nawaz, who was here I think a couple of months earlier, was talking about how the Pakistani army is also changing, and increasingly its lower ranks are populated by soldiers who are not from the cities, who are from villages, and so they're more prone to having sympathies with people in NWFP and Fatah, which he pointed out was a factor in them not being willing to go in and carry out large-scale operations there, while you seem to imply that they do, in fact, do this, which leads to disaffection in these areas and people moving towards supporting the Taliban. That's one. And the other, you seem to suggest that if there was a new secular Pakhtunkhwa or even a state within Pakistan which was under the rule of the secular ANP, then it wouldn't be necessarily such a bad thing for the U.S. policy. But if the Taliban, which has suggested during these peace deals that it does want to take control of the state and did move towards Islamabad, if they indeed are in competition with ANP in the end of NWFP and Fatah, then can it be of interest to U.S. policy that such a state does not come into existence?
I certainly agree with what Shuja said. I think that is a major concern, that the fact of fighting fellow Muslims, fighting fellow Pakistanis, Punjabis fighting Pashtuns. I think the army has been very aware of, very reluctant to be engaged in this kind of situation it now finds itself in. So I agree with that. But the fact is that the U.S. has been pushing ever since Musharraf went in 2002, big operation, left 50,000 people displaced. So we have pushed a reluctant Pakistan army, reluctant for Shuja's reasons, to go into these areas. Why was the army reluctant to go into Swat? Now, some people have an interesting analysis about why it finally went in, why finally you had such strong support for going into Swat, which is that there's a Robin Hood character to the Taliban in Swat, a strong agrarian populist strand, and dispossessing the big landowners in Swat was beginning to move at a rapid pace. And the landed oligarchy in Pakistan didn't like the smell of all this, and the Taliban began to represent to them an end to the, quote, our way of life, unquote. So, but I do agree with you that the army's been properly and understandably reluctant to get into this. It's understood the political limitations of the situation in which it finds itself. But as far as Baitullah Massoud taking over Pakistan, which Hillary has now held up as a threat, and Dick Holbrooke referred to the fall of Swat as if it were Vichy, seems to me this is all missing the point. This is a big problem. Swat is a big problem. The frontier is a big problem. Waziristan is a big problem. The strength of the Taliban is a big problem. But the problem for the stability of the state of Pakistan is the Punjabi Islamists. And that's where the problem is. And their armed strength, the militias and the weapons stockpiles that nobody will touch, that the army is not prepared to touch.
I'm in the back, Virginia. Another Carnegie alumnus.
Thank you, Virginia Foreign Kane from CNA. Hi, Sig.
Hi.
two questions. One is, while you were investigating this What discussions did you have with our military leaders, particularly in CENTCOM and OSD, regarding what, how open they were to defining conditions for the military monies being funded there? While, of course, they're going to be overwhelmingly, we have to protect the transport route, are they understood? They understand the kinds of things that the money is fueling, perhaps, and making their own work difficult. And the second question is, because I have to be a, you know, fit in with the foreign policy here in Washington and discuss a report today that I heard while sitting in traffic on NPR, is a report of a civilian uprising. They have against the Taliban in, I believe they've surrounded two towns. And whether you'd heard about this and know perhaps anything more about it, because we know you have the ear to the ground.
I don't know about that. I did see some reference to something like that, but I haven't tracked it down yet. Well, you know, many there is quite a division among different tribes in the frontier, in WFP and in Fatah. Not all of them have been suborned by Al Qaeda and Taliban by any means. But I have been in contact with David Smith, who was handling these coalition support funds. We've had healthy arguments about this, and in fact, he was one of the first to point out to me that the United States does need the to transport the equipment from Karachi into Afghanistan through Pakistan. I didn't deal directly with anybody at CENTCOM, although I have some people down there I'm in touch with in general. But the whole issue of the CSF has been handled by a very intelligent congressman named John Tierney from Massachusetts, who, as chairman of a House Oversight Committee on Security, and he his committee ran a very long survey, study of the CSF problem, and their report led to the GAO conducting an investigation of the the CSF problem. And two of the staff members of Congressman Tierney's committee, Dave Turk and Andy Wright, were took part in the study group as members of the advisory committee. But when they came to the meetings and participated, and we had the benefit of their discussions, but when they didn't want to be formally considered a part of the study for obvious reasons, someone in Congress. So we've tried to take into account the concerns of the history of this whole problem. And what Congressman Tierney found out was, of course, that the oversight of what was happening to this $700 or $800 million a year in cash subsidies was extremely lax. Ambassador Patterson in Islamabad has been leading the charge to get tighter controls, and now, as a result of Congressman Tierney's effort and her efforts, there are tighter controls on CSF, but it's still a huge subsidy to the armed forces, supposedly, nominally, a repayment for services rendered in the tribal areas. But when you look at the fact that most of the barracks that are being sustained by these funds, the Pakistani troops don't go out of them very often for just the reasons we've been discussing. It's hard to justify most of the CSF money, although I use the language that they should be reduced, the military aid should be substantially reduced, because I don't know how much is justifiable, but certainly the scope of it, plus the weapons approved by Congress in formal military aid, has certainly given the armed forces contributed to the what I call the bloated position of the armed forces in Pakistani society.
Jessica Matthews, Carnegie. Sig, quite apart from the problem of transporting material for Afghanistan, the U.S. government and the military in particular look at this problem and see, I think, two overriding
considerations. One is the conviction that they can't fight a successful military action in Afghanistan with a sanctuary across the border. You know, the feeling that they couldn't do it in the Korean War, we couldn't do it in the Vietnam War, we can't do it here, so we have to do something about the sanctuary. And two, they look at the last 40, 50 years and see a record of military governments in Pakistan being less corrupt, less incompetent, less feckless than civilian governments. So given that, if that's a fair characterization, how does that, if I were General Petraeus, what would you say to me? Let's put it that way.
I would say that you're not going to deal with the situation in Afghanistan quickly. There is no quick fix. And there is no quick fix in Fatah either. And the efforts to have a quick fix are making the problem worse. And therefore, take it easy. We are building our defenses against the kind of horrors that al-Qaeda perpetrated in the past. And we've got to work on our foreign policy so that Muslims are not so antagonistic to the United States in general, which the president started to do at Cairo. And don't be myopic, to go back to the earlier question. There is no quick fix. And if the quick fix is in the Fatah is going to make more terrorists, it's not a sensible policy. The justification for the policy in Afghanistan is not allowing a Taliban government to take power. Well, some of you may know Rory Stewart, who the British writer about Afghanistan, has written a lot of op-eds and things, and I think he may have been here, but he certainly has been at some council meetings that I've attended. And I finally said to him, well, what do you think we should be doing in Afghanistan? And he said, well, we should make sure that Kabul is defended. And many people have, including that... what's his name? The name I can never remember. The French name. I did some very good. Yeah. You pronounce his name for me. And Carnegie has published some excellent studies of the situation in Afghanistan, which would suggest that General Petraeus has some good ideas, but has to listen to these ideas also and scale down what we're doing and not expect to solve this problem right away. And not to expect to solve it if we continue inflicting civilian casualties in Afghanistan, which is a huge problem, and I completely agree with. There's now a conventional wisdom about this. I've been saying this for the last 7 or 8 years. And so I think the answer is that, you know, if any of you read the great novels of the British imperialism called Flashman, if you've read the Flashman series, he put on blackface and went into the Afghan areas and did his deeds. And I didn't want to go into all that in my prepared comments, but I think when I said covert operations, I was nervous about saying special operations, because I'm not sure exactly what that encompasses in the way that the Special Operations Command now operates. But the problem of al-Qaeda can only be dealt with through covert operations. It can't be dealt with airstrikes, and because they create more terrorists. So now I'm beginning to repeat myself. General Petraeus would say, well, we know all that, but we have good intelligence on who these guys are. And then I go back to, and the drones are worth it, and I go back to Bruce Riedel's comment, which is it's like going after a beehive, bee by bee. And so I it's not an easy argument to win, in short, because if you have a myopic approach to a problem at hand, which is very American, you're likely to be impatient with anybody who says there's no quick fix and create a new psychological climate. But I think if you look at the history of our foreign policy messes, including Vietnam and many others, and if you look at what really has counted have been the basic psychological and political context of the problems. No, I would say hire some people like Flashman who knew how to get in there and find these guys.
I would have more covert operations on the ground in the tribal areas. We were in Afghanistan how many years during the Soviet occupation? We built up a huge CIA capability there in Peshawar and in the tribal areas. And there are a lot of guys around who know Afghanistan and know those areas and know where the caves were in those days. And then, of course, we, in a very American way, very myopically, when the Soviets withdrew, we pulled everything out and we closed the station and we didn't have any effective covert operations in that area. So this is a problem that can be dealt with, as I said in my text, through covert operations that do not inflict large-scale civilian casualties that make more terrorists.
Thank you. Paula Stern. My question may evoke a whole other wonderful lecture, and I thank you very much for the one that you presented. It is to relate the ethnic matters that you've described to the various Muslim Islamic movements. You mentioned the Sunni Shia very briefly. I'm wondering what trumps what when it comes to if you're, for example, undertaking covert action. Are you, and you talked about the Mullah Malik references. My question has to do with, you know, weaving in together with the ethnic discussions of the Pashtun, et cetera, with the various other religious schisms that exist. And if I could add to it a little bit, you also mentioned assistance coming from the Gulf, sometimes from Pashtuns in the Gulf, et cetera. There's a lot of funding, as we all know, going from the Gulf and from other wealthy Arab, Saudi Arabia, et cetera. Again, what trumps what in terms of religion and the schisms within the religion versus the ethnic Pashtun versus the Punjabis? If you could kind of relate those, I'd appreciate it just to embellish and embroider a little more.
I agree with the conventional wisdom that there is an Islamist danger in Pakistan. There's a danger to the Pakistani state. Back? Okay. Yeah. But this danger comes from Islamist groups operating in the Punjab, centered in the Punjab, protected in the Punjab, with encampments and militias in the Punjab and in the Kashmir camps that Lashkar-e-Taiba has. These are on the Sunni side.
Right.
And so the problem in dealing with the Islamist threat is twofold. First, it is to disarm those militias and get their weapons out of those camps. And this would require a very ugly military showdown on the part of the Pakistan Army, and it's opposed by many elements within the Army and within the ISI who want to keep these guys in reserve. Now, there's a secondary problem, which is that this Baitullah Masood has emerged with his and some of his allies in SWAT and in parts of the NWFP, which is a serious military problem, and maybe it has to be dealt with. So that's a secondary but important part of the Islamist problem. What I was trying to emphasize is that there are secular Pashtuns in the Northwest Frontier Province. U.S. interests lie, and this report goes into this at some length, in trying to support what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So if General Petraeus, I were talking to General Petraeus, I would say, go to see Asfandiar Wali Khan, go to see Afrasab Cuttack. These are two of the people in the Awami National Party. Mm-hmm. They're in a terrible position now. They have to take care of 2 million refugees that Pakistani and U.S. policy and the Taliban's policy have produced. Mm-hmm. And whatever can be done can only be done effectively through these secular Pashtun elements. And maybe it's too late to do as much as we would hope to do. So you have to have covert action to protect U.S. interests on the immediate problem of finding the hideouts of the al-Qaeda. So, but the notion that the Taliban problem in the frontier is going to spill over into taking over the state of Pakistan is totally, to me, without foundation. It's a danger in that it could create Islamist dominance of the Pashtuns. And then you could have the danger. Then you have the danger either of a very estranged Pashtun population, hostile and conducting terrorist activities. You could have a Pashtunistan at some future time, starting with a small coalition of certain leaders saying this emirate of this area of Waziristan is an emirate. But so scenarios for how you could end up with an independent Pashtunistan are very hard to sketch. And I simply said the psychological and political seeds of this are still there, and we shouldn't forget that that's one of the possibilities in the picture, given the alienation of the Pashtuns. Now, but I contrasted with this Islamist problem in the Punjab,
yes,
which is where our boys are, with the areas that are being mistreated by the Punjab in Balochistan and Sindh, where you have the strongest groups are secular. The word secular with Islam is, let's say, moderate Islam. I don't know what you want to say, but the type of Islam that the Sufi Islam represents, that you find in the Sindh, that you find in Balochistan, there's very little hospitality there to the Punjabi Islamists. However,
it's Sufi then.
Yeah, they're mostly Sufi. Yes, they're Sufis. The Shias are, I guess, about an 18% minority in Pakistan. Incidentally, a lot of the big landholders in the Punjab are Shias. And therefore, you have the Sunni Lashkar-e-Taiba as the Robin Hood against the big landowners. But anyway, the point is that you have the strongholds of secular Islam or moderate Islam in Pakistan are in Balochistan and the Sindh, and there is a substantial secular Pashtun tradition in the Northwest Frontier Province, which hasn't lost out yet. It's won all the seats in the National Assembly from the Northwest Frontier Province. So the problem is in the Punjab and the military capabilities of these groups there and their connections with the people we are supporting in Pakistan. That's the Islamist problem in Pakistan as I see it. But there is something I should say. The Lashkar-e-Taiba and these other groups have been working very hard to try to create beachheads in the Sindh and Balochistan. And they're doing it particularly in Karachi, where there are a lot of Pashtuns,
yes,
and there are a lot of Punjabis, and it's a multi-ethnic melange. There are Sindhis and Baluchis, but they don't dominate Karachi. And the Muhajirs are opposing the invasion of the what they call the Talibanization of Karachi. So there are places in Sindh where the Lashkar-e-Taiba goes in with a lot of money and establishes a madrasa. And so you do have madrasas in the Sindh and a few in Balochistan, but basically it's not a hospitable climate for this.
I'm going to wrap us up, and I want to thank Sig. I want to thank all of you for a great discussion. Obviously, this one's not going to be solved anytime soon, so I can imagine we will
be able to return to this topic and hope that we'll see you at a future event. So thank you very much, and thank you, Sig.